Ritual and Myth in Ancient and Modern Times, this week on Soundings. Hello, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation about Scandinavian myth. I'll talk with Margaret Clunies Ross, a professor of English at the University of Sydney. Later on the show this week, a discussion of dance and ritual play in ancient Greek society. You'll hear from Stephen Lonsdale, a professor of classics at Davidson College. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated.
You can't give a simple answer to this one. There are some myths which are intimately connected with religion and religious ritual. The Christian myth, for example, about the nature and the life of Christ would be one such. There are other myths which don't have any obvious close correspondence in a religious practice or a religious belief.
Margaret Clunies Ross teaches at the University of Sydney, where she specializes in the study of Germanic myth and legend. She says that myths are sacred narratives that interested previous generations of scholars because of the stories they told about the creation of the world and humankind's relation to divine or unknowable forces. By contrast, 20th century scholars have tended to look at myth as a cultural product, part of mythic systems that embrace not only religion and literature, but other important artistic forms, such as dance, music, and the visual arts. I asked Margaret Clunies Ross to discuss what she calls the future of Germanic myth.
Well, during the past year, I think you know, I've been writing a book about Old Norse mythology, that is, the myths that have been left to us by medieval Scandinavian writers, many of whom, at the time they wrote the myths down, were actually Christian, so we're sort of looking back through their eyes at the past. But even given that, there has come down to us from early Scandinavia a set of stories and poems about the old Germanic and Scandinavian gods, gods like Odin, Thor, Freya, Balder.
How extensive is this body of literature?
It's quite extensive. Probably the most important evidence about what people thought then comes in a collection of poetry called the Poetry of the Elder Edda, which is a collection of poems about the old gods and heroes, and in a prose work which quotes quite a lot of this poetry as well, and that is the Prose Edda of an Icelandic writer living in the early 13th century by name of Snorri Sturluson.
Wonderful name, wonderful name. Are these myths prescriptions for human action, descriptions of the way the gods live? How about the interaction between the two?
Yes, well, it's not very clearly marked, interestingly enough. I think that's one thing that does differentiate Norse mythology from some others. Humans are in there somewhere, but they're not very prominent. And the relationship between gods and humans, even though, as far as we know from the records of early Scandinavian ritual, was important, nevertheless isn't really much inscribed in the myths. The myths are really about the gods and the world they live in, that is, the myths are about a world in the past where important creator beings were working, were creating the world as we know it. For example, the earliest gods created the cosmos from the body parts of an ancient giant. They murdered him and they chucked his eyes up in the sky, and they used his brains for clouds and so forth, that kind of thing. But then there are lots of other myths too, which deal with an imagined mythological world, which is not exactly the human world, but clearly mirrors it. And many of those myths deal with the relationships between the gods and giants, who are their main adversaries.
In these adversarial relationships, does one find instruction for human politics, the relationships between and among men and women and children. And I mean, how commonplace really are these themes, notwithstanding the grand setting in which they occur?
Well, you couldn't. They are not sort of prescriptive in the sense that they don't set out, you know, how someone should behave. There are old Norse poems that do talk about that sort of thing, but they are not basically about mythological or supernatural beings. But nevertheless, the myths are obviously about things that concern humans, and I think this is one point that I feel very strongly, that myths are socially and culturally engaged.
Do you have a favorite Margaret Clooney's Ross, one that comes back and resonates in your mind? What would that be?
Well, I like a lot of them. That's why I write about them. Well, let me tell one, and this is in the version that we have it in Snorri Sturluson's Edda, by the way. Once upon a time, as all good fairy tales begin, and the structure of this myth has a folktale structure too. Once upon a time, three gods went journeying away from their home in Ásgarðr, and they came upon a flock of oxen, and they killed one because they were hungry, and tried to cook it in an earth oven. But the meat wouldn't cook. And they became aware that there was an eagle sitting above them in a tree, and somehow or other they twigged to the fact that this was no ordinary eagle, but a giant. And he was stopping their meat from cooking.
Why?
Because he wanted it for himself, of course. And he also wanted to bug them, because gods and giants are in an adversarial relationship. You have to understand that in this mythological world.
Is it to the point to ask who wins this confrontation?
Yeah, it's very much to the point. In the end, the gods win, but the giant almost wins, and this is where the tension gets pretty tight. He succeeds in cooking their meat, but he demands a share, and so they give him a share, but he takes too much. And one of the gods, Loki, gets angry and strikes at this giant in the form of an eagle with a pole. And the pole sticks to Loki, and the eagle flies off with him and drags him over the ground, over rocks, and hurts him really rather badly. And Loki's crying for mercy, and the eagle says, "Okay, well, I'll let you go, but on one condition, of course," as in all good myths.
All right.
"And that is that you will bring to me Idhun, who is one of the goddesses, and she happens to have some apples of immortality."
Ah, the love angle and the religion angle.
Yeah, well, yes, quite a lot of that. And so he agrees, but and he entices her out and abducts her for this giant. Well, the gods are pretty upset by this, and more so because this Idhun has the apples which keep them from aging, and they start to get old. So they must get her back, and in the end they persuade Loki to go and get her back, and I won't tell all the complications of this because it would be too long, but he eventually does recover her and takes her back to the dwelling of the gods in the form of a hazelnut in his mouth. He's also in the form of a bird, by the way. But the giant, Thjatsi by name, pursues Loki, and Loki just makes it back to Ásgarðr, and the gods have lit an enormous fire on the inside of the walls, and the eagle, unfortunately, in his desire to get Idhun back again, flies too low, has his wings singed, and falls down, whereupon the gods kill him. And that's the end of that part of the myth. There is a sequel to it, but I'm not going to tell it now.
All right, now, do the stories that you are looking at, Margaret Clooney's Ross, do they have, what shall we call them, analogies in the modern world? Are they, do they continue to reverberate in our common human nature? And in fact, is that one of the assumptions underscoring the telling and the interpretation of these myths, that we really have something in common with these cultures and peoples who are so far removed from us in space and time?
Well, I think if we understand something of what these myths are about, then they do resonate. But I think one of the characteristics of myths anyway is that they resonate even if we don't quite understand how they relate to our world, because they usually express a number of sort of important things about the human condition. In this particular case of the one I just told, there's obviously a point to be made about the relationship between hostile groups of people and the way in which they exchange women or don't exchange them, as the case may be, because in this particular mythological situation there is an implicit embargo on the giants taking or getting women from the gods' side. And a number of myths deal with this particular topic. So the relationship between groups, marriage patterns if you like, that kind of thing is an important issue. There are also issues to do with hierarchy and social control, power.
How do we know, Margaret Clooney's Ross, I want to be politely impertinent, how do we know that the way you read these things as a scholar here in the modern world is in fact faithful to the intentions and the purposes, the designs of the people who put these myths together? Do they mean to us what they meant to them?
Well, that's almost an unanswerable question. But I think many of us who are working with this material these days do try, although we know it's hard, to get some idea of the nature of the corpus of Norse myth. We don't look at individual myths on their own. We try to see myths like the one I just talked about.
This is what you call the mythic system.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. We try to, as it were, recreate the world into which individual myths fit. We try to relate what is going on in the myths to what we know about early Scandinavian society and culture in other dimensions. And so we try to understand their structure and their function in an intellectual cultural sense, which is what I think modern anthropology has taught us to do in relation to contemporary cultures. Many of which have important similarities with the older cultures of Northern Europe.
Give me a quick answer to this question, Margaret. Do your students like this stuff? Oh, I mean, is it popular? Is it fun for kids today? Or is this really the domain of a rather arcane kind of scholarship?
Oh, no, I don't think so. In my own university, University of Sydney, I always have good numbers in my classes on Norse mythology, and the students love it. But, you know, there's an awful lot of this around in the modern world. I mean, you must have seen Thor comics, you've undoubtedly seen various types of fantasy films which are based quite a lot on Norse mythology.
Absolutely.
Well, and of course the works of Tolkien, many other modern writers of fantasy are absolutely based on this stuff. And if it hadn't existed, those writings and those products would never have come about.
Margaret Clooney's Ross, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You've been visiting here at the Humanities Center working on a book about Old Norse mythology. You are a professor at the University of Sydney. Good luck in your work.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
You're listening to Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond.
We must spend our whole lives playing at certain games, sacrifice, singing, and dancing, so as to win the gods' favor, protect ourselves from our enemies, and conquer them in battle. So Plato summarizes the chief ritual duties of pious citizens and the benefits derived from the dance and ritual play in the laws, a vital contemporary source for ancient Greek dance and music.
Stephen Lonsdale is a professor of classics at Davidson College. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a new book entitled Dance and Ritual Play in Greek Religion, a study spanning the 500-year period that concludes with the death of Alexander the Great in the year 323 before the Common Era. Stephen Lonsdale says that dance in ancient Greek culture played overlapping roles as an act of divine adoration and as an expression of human festivity. For the Greeks, in other words, dance was both a social mechanism and a form of ritual behavior. Stephen Lonsdale.
There is a festival that took place on the central island in the Aegean of Delos in 522 BC, which was organized by Polycrates of Samos, a tyrant from that neighboring island.
Not exactly a household name today, but
that's right.
Nonetheless.
But this was a gathering point for people from the islands and from the coast of Asia Minor. And it was one of those occasions when cities would send these representative choruses, which probably had been selected by a competitive process, by sort of singling them out the way that we do in the Olympics.
Uh-huh.
We have pre-trials, and you know, finally you get an Olympic team and you send it off. And that is showing your best, and then it is on display there. And it's not on just human display, but I come back to this idea of there being a divine witness. So to be on the right track to attain your goal, you have to model, you have to make your realization of the dance something like what is going on Olympus when the gods are celebrating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these, of course, are projections by poets and artists of human festivity. But I think that the important illusion that can be missed is that these are the primordial dances. These are the dances that have existed from the beginning of the world. There has been an ordering force in the cosmos that has come about, and there may have been disruption and disorder in settling, say, the Olympian dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
And there will have been at some point when Zeus has triumphed over the preceding dynasty, a display in a dance showing that he now is the central choregos, the leader of the choros, and he is marshaling the other divinities around him.
Let's follow that word marshaling up. Again, refer to your book here. That is to say weapons and the military. What about that?
I look at dance very much in relation to status transition rites. That's an anthropological term to show that there are certain crucial points in the process of growing up. For instance, when you move from being a child to being an adolescent, or an adolescent to being a full member of society, and there are rituals that mark that. And for a man, the weapon dance, well, let me put that in a more general way, showing that you could effectively fight on the battlefield,
mm-hmm.
was the way that you became a full member of the polis.
Well, here you make me think of a story like The Bear by William Faulkner, a little boy going out and learning to participate in these rituals of manhood, adulthood.
Yes, and I think that hunting was the sort of preliminary, preceding phase. Hunting and warfare are very closely connected in the Greek world. And so one of the dances done by say Athenian males 18 to 20 was a weapon dance with a shield, with a spear, with a helmet. You had to show that under duress of probably a competitive situation and in full view of the assembled polis, that you could move gracefully with the weapon, the heavy weaponry, and that you could do it in an ensemble, because there was a rank and file, you know, there was a sort of line of warriors, and it was by the 5th century, the time I'm talking about, the emphasis wasn't so much on an individual's flourish in battle, but the cooperative phalanx.
Did this extend to women? How did it involve
now,
women?
This is a very interesting question, because in Athens, where you have a weapon, a war goddess, Athena, you do see representations in vase painting of women doing this weapon dance, which we know young men and older men did in many contexts. And so the question is, what are we being shown here by the vase painter? Are they doing some similar rite of passage? One of the possibilities is that when we see a young woman dancing with weapons, that it is a kind of a parody, a social parody, saying, well, we have a war goddess, but we don't give our young women weapons, we don't, you know, allow them to be citizens. I don't happen to agree with that position, but that's one of the difficulties that anyone interpreting visual sources for dance must confront.
What about questions of courtship and marriage? I mean, here we've talked about young men, young women. Now we're going to we're going to talk about one of the institutions of society.
That's right. As you've picked up, these dances ordinarily were done by gender-exclusive groups. But there are certain times when young men and women come together, and that is on the dancing ground. That is an acceptable time for them to show off their bodies, to, in the case of women, dress in loose garments, and to show off their wares, so to speak. They're not doing it just for the potential grooms. The family will be looking on as well.
This was not looked upon as some sort of a sexist exercise. I mean, obviously, there must have been an erotic dimension to it, but because of this ritual constraint, it wasn't misinterpreted or misconstrued?
I think that there was the potential for that. Dance, when it's done in an orderly way, can be an organ of social control. It is a way of keeping limits.
But it can also be a way to move beyond
limits. Exactly, and that's exactly really what's wanted in a courtship dance. You want to disrupt the old social order where, you know, your daughter or son is sort of hanging around the house, and you want to
you want to get them out.
Want to get them out.
Yeah.
So dance does have a sort of propelling effect, but there is a very interesting mythological motif, and that is about the abduction of a young girl from a dancing ground. And it's usually a god or a mature hero who does this. And
yeah, kidnapping was popular with these Greek gods and goddesses, wasn't it?
Yes, and this relates to the idea of possession, that there is something desirable about being recognized as being kale in the dance, being beautiful in the dance, and having that complemented by a divine presence. Plato said that the gods are co-partners in the dance. Sun choreotai is the word in Greek. And so this goes back to the idea of evoking the divine presence and bringing it into one's body, temporarily at least.
How, Stephen Lonsdale, does all of this move into our modern world? I mean, is it possible, as a scholar of ancient Greek culture and society, do you think in terms of analogies? Now, I say this with a straight face. Do you turn on the TV, for example, and look at American Bandstand or MTV or something like that, and find here in our expressive culture manifestations of the same kind of thing that you're studying in Greek culture?
I do, but I want first to say that what's so different is that when you have American Bandstand or MTV...
Now we're dating ourselves with it.
Although it may have a cultic aspect to it, it really doesn't... It's not circumscribed by any kind of formal religion or even...
It's idiosyncratic.
It's very... Yes, it's idiosyncratic, and I think much of it actually is very narcissistic. I don't mean that in any sort of judgmental way, but there is quite a lot of either, you know, sometimes you go to discotheques and people will be actually dancing before a mirror, or they will choose a partner who mirrors them in some way. Now, this is different from dancing before the image of a god. In a Greek, ancient Greek context,
there was a much more social and deliberate function to what was going on here in this ritual play and dance.
It was far more pervasive. I mean, the idea of our being able to influence what was going on during the Persian Gulf War crisis with sort of dances is absurd. But that was to sacrifice and to dance and sing before a war was just ordinary. If you didn't do it, you didn't have a chance. I mean, we have military parades and that sort of thing, but I think that we've become much more compartmentalized in the political and the ritual.
As a footnote to our conversation, Stephen Lonsdale, would you rather live now or then?
Oh, for many reasons, I probably would rather live now, because I can see these ancient rituals through a great continuum and with great perspective, and it's enriched all cultures that have gradually reached us. And I feel in some ways that I have been able to go back and look at aspects of ancient Greek society.
Uh-huh. Stephen Lonsdale, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. Your book is Dance and Ritual Play in Greek Religions. We can look forward to this from the Johns Hopkins University Press. Good luck in your work. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Wayne.
You're listening to Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette copy of this week's show. My guests were Margaret Clunies Ross of the University of Sydney and Stephen Lonsdale of Davidson College. Margaret Clunies Ross is at work on a book about Old Norse and Germanic myth. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Stephen Lonsdale worked on a study of dance and ritual play in ancient Greek religion. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 634. That's number 634, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Next week, conversations with two leading literary historians. Dennis Donahue of University College Dublin and New York University offers an overview of contemporary literary criticism. David Ellis of the University of Kent at Canterbury will discuss his biography of the British writer D.H. Lawrence. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Thank you for listening to Soundings. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Ritual and Myth in Ancient and Modern Times, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Margaret Clunies Ross of the University of Sydney talks about Scandinavian myth and legend. Stephen Lonsdale of Davidson College discusses dance, ritual, and ancient Greek religion. Ritual and Myth, Then and Now, this week on Soundings.